Welcome to this year's Anglican Church League Synod Briefing Podcast. I'm Andrew Bruce, the Rector of the Parish of St. Peter's Cooks River and President of the League. I've been part of Synod for 8 years now and am on a number of diocesan committees, including the Diocesan Resources Committee and the Licensing Review Panel, both of which report to this year's Synod. Let me introduce our panel for today, all of whom are current and long-standing members of Standing Committee. We are joined today by Dr. Robert Tong, who is a lawyer and the chair of committees in Synod, among many other things. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks, Andrew.
We are also joined today by Canon Phil Colgan, and he is the rector of St. George North. He's the deputy chair of committees in Synod and is on the Diocesan Resources Committee, among a number of other things. Welcome, Phil.
Great to be here, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
In addition, we are joined today by Dr. Claire Smith, who is a New Testament scholar and serves on various diocesan committees and the General Synod Doctrine Commission. Welcome, Claire.
Thanks, Andrew. Great to be here.
Before we start, a couple of community service announcements. Firstly, if you're not already a member of the ACL, please visit our website at acl.asn.au for more information on how to apply for membership of the League. Secondly, a reminder, we have the annual Church League dinner on the first night of Synod with Phil Colgan speaking on Proclaim or Apologise, Sharing Christ in a Post-Christian World. Also, we'd like to note the change of venue for this year's dinner. It's at St Andrew's Cathedral School's Bishop Barry Centre. So you enter via 51 Druitt Street. So it's not at Chapter House. It's not at Chapter House. It's at 51 Druitt Street. So friends, here is the shape of our podcast today. Firstly, Robert Tong will give an introduction to Synod for those of you who may not have been before or maybe haven't been for a while, so that you too can make a crucial contribution to our diocese through the life of Synod, which will hopefully impact the ability of local Sydney churches to proclaim the gospel. Following on from that, we will consider some specific issues to this year's Synod and hear from our panel who have read through the material and are active members of the Standing Committee to help us understand what we might want to look out for, as well as discussing what the implications of passing these resolutions might be. So for those of you who haven't been to Synod before, I would like to give a little introduction into how Synod does its business and how you can contribute. So Robert, what are the key elements of how Synod meets and how can people make a contribution in Synod?
Yes, Andrew. What happens at Synod follows a structure. The daily business paper provides the batting order. The Synod books, that's electronic or printed, and the printed runs for several hundred pages, provide the actual detail, and the business rules dictate how Synod business is conducted. So, the batting order is in the business paper. The Synod books provide all the detail, and the business rules show how the business is actually conducted. It's very formal. However, the Archbishop endeavours to help Synod members negotiate their way. So, don't be afraid to stand up and ask a question. I want to do something, how do I go about doing it? When you look at the business paper, you'll find there are motions, there are ordinances, and there are presentations. Motions, ordinances, and presentations. And the business rules will tell you how those things are dealt with. If this is your first time, or you are daunted by all the paper, then here are some simple questions to help you get to the heart of the business item. You can say to yourself, or you could ask yourself, what is the intent of this motion? What is the move of trying to get across and to persuade you to agree to it? If it's an ordinance, what rules will change or what new rules will be introduced? How will they affect you? How will they affect your parish? How will they affect ministry? So if you work through those sorts of questions, that might awaken in you a way to make a contribution. You might want to ask a question in the debate or actually contest something the speaker has said, either the mover of the motion or a previous speaker. So stand up and see if you can get the call from the Archbishop, or if it's in the committee stage of an ordinance, that is, we're debating the words, then the chairman of committees may give you the call. What sort of outcome do you want? I think in very broad terms, an improvement or an enhancement of the way ministry is conducted in the parish, or if it's something more personal, will this improve the way we care for people and promote the gospel?
Thanks, Robert. It's very instructive as to how Synod operates. Friends, if you want to find out a bit more detail, you can, of course, go to the Anglican Church League website, and there you'll find a PDF version of Robert's Synod Survival Guide, which will help you better understand how Synod conducts its business. Looking at this year's papers, it seems to me the biggest issue to discuss at this year's Synod will be the proposal in relation to the Bathurst Diocese. So, Robert, can you tell us what's at the heart of this issue?
The answer to the question is ministry and money. Ministry and money. Two M's, not five M's. Let me just expand a little bit. On the money, Bathurst Diocese over the last couple of years have run into severe financial difficulty. A lot of its history now. There was a substantial loan to the Commonwealth Bank, which has now had to go to court. That's now been solved. The bishop's endowment has been run down so that the present bishop works as a part-time rector of Dubbo and then runs the diocese with very little resources. He's a godly man and keen to see ministry throughout the whole diocese, but hamstrung by a critical lack of financial resources and clergy resources. On the ministry side, again, the diocese has something like 30 clergy, only about 8 or 9 are full-time, the rest are part-time. There are a significant number of vacant parishes, and so that's the current background. The bishop is due to retire. In fact, he's actually given notice that he will finish early next year, and so the diocese will be looking for a new bishop, and given the paucity of ministry manpower and finances, there have been conversations between Ian Palmer, the current bishop, and the Archbishop of Sydney as to whether Sydney can lend a hand to get the Diocese of Bathurst back on an even footing to enable ministry to flourish.
Thanks, Robert. So what is actually proposed?
The heart of the proposal is, well, actually there are two parts. One is that the Archbishop of Sydney will have a critical voice in the election of a new Bishop of Bathurst, and secondly, that the Sydney Synod will provide some financial resources for a six-year period. So that, as to the first, the Bathurst Diocese have changed their election ordinance, the Bishop election ordinance, to allow the Archbishop of Sydney to have a critical role in the person of who the next bishop of Bathurst will be. If the Archbishop of Sydney is not satisfied with a name, then the rest of the proposal from Sydney falls to the ground. The finance aspects will be that, and this is what our Synod will be asked to agree to, is to provide a sum of $250,000 per annum for a period of 6 years, and that money will be spent in funding the bishop and the registrar of the diocese. And that will provide the critical central infrastructure for allowing a diocese to function.
So, Robert, it seems to me a key question to ask is, what happens if we don't do this proposal?
It's not altogether clear. There are some theories that if a diocese fails, then it will collapse back into the diocese from which it was originally carved. So if you follow that theory, Sydney would then just expand and absorb Bathurst. It's not altogether clear that is in fact what will happen, because under the General Synod arrangements, Bathurst is a separate diocese. I think practically, when the bishop retires, the Bishop Election Committee will look for someone, and then they would need to persuade a person to become a bishop where there's no endowment to guarantee a stipend, and who knows who would accept that sort of challenge. And then there's the other challenges of scarcity of both money and clergy.
Claire, what do you think? Is this a good idea for the Diocese of Sydney?
Thanks, Andrew. Yes, I think this is a good gospel opportunity for the Diocese of Sydney for a number of reasons. The first is that these are Anglican believers who are in our state with whom we already have a relationship, and they're asking us to help them and really asking us to help them to progress evangelical gospel-based ministry. And so I think this is a great opportunity. I think also many of us have friends in the Bathurst Diocese and family, and this is part of the state also with the drought and the challenges of regionalism that's asking us to help them. And we're concerned, we've been concerned with drought relief and so on, and this is some way that we can really progress gospel ministry in this diocese. The other issue is the issue of money. I guess some people will say, well, that's a lot of money, maybe we could give to other things. I guess my answer would be, there are always, that's one of the issues with ministry, there are always good things that we can spend our money on, and we have to decide, is this a particular opportunity at this time that hasn't been there before but has now come to us? And I think this is an expression of generous gospel-based fellowship to move ahead with this plan.
Thanks, Claire, helping us understand this a bit better. Phil, what do you think? Is this a good idea for us as the Diocese of Sydney?
I must admit, I'm still torn on this one. I think at the moment I'm aiming to vote in favour of it. But just to help our listeners, if you like, I think it's worth thinking about what would someone who's against it say? What would the arguments be? And the big one in the end is this the best use of $250,000 a year for the next 6 years? That's what people have to decide. Are the opportunities for evangelical gospel ministry by doing this in Bathurst, is that the best use of that money compared to other things the money could be spent on? I think the other argument against would be, some would ask, do we get enough out of that money? Is the influence over the appointment of the Bishop of Bathurst sufficient to make it a worthwhile use of our money? They're the sort of things people would need to think through. As I say, at the moment, I'm leaning towards perhaps it is an opportunity that has come up at this particular time that we can take for a reasonably small investment compared to the size of things we do spend other amounts on. I think, though, the other sort of elephant in the room a little bit is if the Diocese of Bathurst does become insolvent, for want of a better word, who takes on the redress claims that will come down the path? So one argument in favour of this is, by us giving this money to Bathurst, we're helping them to continue to continue their ministry, continue to remain afloat, and so they will continue to be responsible for redress claims that come into the future, rather than entering that great unknown of, do they fold into the Diocese of Sydney? Do they come under the General Synod? As Robert said before, we just really don't know what would happen in that circumstance.
Thanks, friends. I think that's been a very instructive conversation about what are the key elements of the proposal that are coming before us at this Synod, and really cut to the heart of what it is we need to think about. And can I encourage our listeners that really we've got to stop and reflect and try and decide for ourselves what is the best long-term gospel opportunity in terms of how we should spend this money, but indeed how we should help in fellowship with others. They're the things you've got to weigh up. The second largest issue, it seems to me, that we're dealing with in this synod is the money bills. It's important for us to work out how, as a synod, we are going to spend our money in supporting gospel endeavours and gospel ministry. So, Phil, you're on the Diocesan Resources Committee. Can you explain to our listeners what are the basic elements of the bills, how they work, and what are the key elements that people should be aware of?
the money bills are only important in so much as they support gospel ministry. That's why they're important. It's really, really important for synod members to actually understand the process we go through. With some exceptions over the years, due to different financial conditions and so forth, we try and budget for a triennium. That's a three-year period. And so this year, we're coming into one of those trienniums. So at this year's Synod in 2018, we're effectively setting the budget for the diocese for the years 2019, 20 and 21. Now, the way that process works is a year earlier, so at last year's Synod in 2017, we agreed on a statement of funding principles. Now, that's the basis on which these budgets have been prepared for the next 3 years. Now, our budget is broken into two different parts, and they come to the Synod as two different ordinances. The first is what we do with our central funds. And so you find that in Book 3 of your materials, starting on page 335. And that is what we do with the money that comes from the endowment, basically. So as you look at that this year, there has actually been an increase in the amount of funds available to the Synod for this next triennium, and especially for 2019. That comes about because of the way St Andrew's House is now being treated as a separate investment. The money mainly comes from that source, but also there are some generous parishes who deserve our thanks because they contribute from large property investments on the whole to the central funds. Now, that all works out this year at around a $600,000 increase in the amount of money to be distributed. Now, as it stands, the budget that's coming to Synod, the ordinance that's coming to Synod, $250,000 of that is allocated to the Bathurst proposal. So if that gets up, then it will be contained within the money bill. If it doesn't, we'll then have to work out how to spend that money differently in future years. In addition, the two organisations that are receiving notable increases in their allocations are Ministry Training and Development and the Anglican Education Commission. And basically, they are getting enough money, extra money, because they have not really been able to keep what they're required to do, doing what they're required to do under their ordinances without an increase. And so we're basically saying we're investing in those organisations for the next couple of years to try and help them do what we want them to do. The other increase worth noting is to the Work Outside the Diocese Committee. Back when we had some financial troubles, that decreased down to a lower percentage, but the Synod has expressed in the past that it would like to see that back up to 5% of the Synod budget, and so we're increasing that to 5% under this proposed ordinance. Other organisations are receiving small increases to enable them to keep doing what they're doing, not necessarily put on new people, but effectively not have to put off other workers or stop doing other work. Some people might say, what about new initiatives? Well, effectively, if we want to do new initiatives, if we want to spend money on other things, we do need to say which of these other ones we stop funding. So people need to understand that, that you would need to reallocate money away from these other things in order to do new things. So you would have to argue why the Anglican Education Commission or Anglican Media or Youth Works or Moore College or whatever other thing we're currently funding should not receive the current level of funding or the increase that's proposed in order to come up with money for a new initiative. I think it's important for people to understand that for money to go to somewhere else, it has to come from something we're currently funding. The other part of the Dawson budget and the other ordinance is the parish cost recoveries. It's a bit confusing in our book because it's not on page 320. That's an old version of the ordinance. It's now on page 358 of Book 3. And parish cost recoveries are all those things that parishes would have to pay regardless of whether they were part of the diocese or not. That's the basic distinction between what gets paid for out of the endowment and what gets paid for by parish cost recoveries. So parish cost recoveries, there's different parts of it. Some are tied to your ordained staff, and the majority of that for each staff member goes towards paying for superannuation, long service leave and other insurances. But the other part of parish cost recoveries is based on the parish's offertories 2 years prior. So for this year, it would be based on a parish's offertories in 2017 determines what amount of parish cost recoveries they pay in 2019. And then there is the 2% levy on offertories, again, from 2 years prior, that will go towards paying for greenfield site. The thing to note in your papers this year is there is quite a large increase in that general amount of PCR this year. It's going from about 5% to 6.4%, and then smaller increases proposed for 2020 and 2021. By far, the majority of that increase is due to the increased insurance costs. And so that's worked out by the Property Trust. And so you'll see that discussed in your papers. The other things that are leading to that increase are increasing costs for our professional standards unit. As we give our professional standards unit more to do, we have to pay for it. Also, there's a new property trust fee structure where previously it was only parishes with money invested in the long-term pooling fund who would contribute a fee. Now that is in recognition that the property trust serves all the parishes. All parishes are contributing to the cost of the property trust through the PCR. And then there's then a couple of other smaller amounts to do with support of spouses where clergy have had to resign from ministry and other matters that PCR lead to the PCR increase.
Thanks, Phil. That's a lot of information distilled into an understandable way. It's the money bills themselves are quite complex beasts. I'm on the Diocesan Resources Committee, and they are difficult to engage with. And so Phil's done us a great service there. In less than 3 minutes, he's explained something that can be quite complex. It probably even warrants going back and just listening to that again, just so you get each of the elements of how the bills come together. What are the key moments? I think it's really important to acknowledge the connection here between the decision we make on the Bathurst Diocese and how it relates to the money bills. Anyway, thanks, Phil, for that great insight. One of the reports to this year's Synod that it would be easy to pass over without paying too much attention to is the one called An Evangelical Episcopate. I think it's a really valuable report. And so, Claire, this is an area of interest for you, being on the General Synod Doctrine Commission. So you're into Doctrine Commission reports. Why is this worth spending some time studying this report and really taking on board what it has to say?
Yeah, that's right, Andrew. It's really easy with the amount of reading for Synod to lose sight of some of the really great things that are in there. This report from the Doctrine Commission is in Book 1 on page 50. And I have to say, having read it just again in the last couple of days, it's a really great report. And we really should be so grateful for the Doctrine Commission, the Sydney Doctrine Commission, the way they serve us. It covers the biblical material. It covers the historical material in the Diocese of Sydney, which is really interesting. And also looks at the contemporary role of the Archbishop and how our archbishops are to serve us in the role of the archbishops. And really, they boil it down to five priorities that they see for the archbishop, and they are they're encouraging to read. The first priority of the archbishop is to be a guardian of the faith once for all delivered to the saints, that is, to promote and defend the gospel, to proclaim it publicly, and by personal example to lead in gospel-based ministry. The second priority of the Archbishop of Sydney is to order the ministry of the diocese to the gospel of Christ and its mission. So the helpful thing is just seeing how gospel proclamation is to the fore in the role of the archbishop. The third priority is the exercise of pastoral concern and insight as he provides advice and direction for gospel ministry in the diocese. Again, gospel-based. The fourth is to represent the diocese. That's both in our society, in the broader church, around the world. And the fifth is in the administration of the diocese, in the advancement of the mission. Sometimes looking at the role of the archbishop, it can seem as if the administrative aspect of that role can dominate. But what's helpful in this report is just the priority to the gospel, defending biblical truth, knowing biblical truth. And I really like the way that the last paragraph highlights the importance of the personal Christian character of the archbishop and prayerfulness and faithful obedience to the word of God. So generally it's an encouraging report to read, but also gave me great thanks for the archbishops who have served the diocese in the past and present. And also as I thinking in 2 years' time and facing an Archbishop's election, just a helpful report to really revisit what it is we're wanting in an Archbishop, and to once again just be reminded of God's faithfulness to us and to pray for God's faithfulness to us in the future.
Thanks, Claire, for helping us walk through that report, but and especially in a thanks to our Doctrine Commission under the chairmanship of Dr. Mark Thompson. They give us great service in helping us to understand and distill biblical truths to important subjects that we want to understand, and helping us do our business as a synod. Moving on to our next subject today, we're going to look at the large receipts policy. You may be thinking this is a topic that's been around for a little time, and you'd be right. And so we really want to get to the heart of the issue. So, Phil, what is at the heart of this policy?
Thanks, Andrew. Yeah, this one really has hung around the Synod for a long time, and I think many Synod members, including the one speaking now, are probably a bit sick and tired of it. But it's really, really important that we not allow that to limit our debate of it and work towards getting the best outcome. You've got to go back decades, really. The large receipts policy stems from the fact that for some time, for many, many years, the Synod has agreed that where parishes receive large receipts from property income and the like, things other than offertories, they should share those with the rest of the diocese. That's the basic underlying point of our large receipts policy. But what's worked out over time is that it hasn't really been applied fairly, because only parishes with a lease over $50,000 are required to bring an ordinance to standing committee. And so some parishes are caught, for want of a better word, by the large receipts policy. But another parish might have five licenses of $40,000. So they're getting $200,000 of property income, but they never bring an ordinance. And so the large property receipts policy doesn't apply. So that's why for many years there's been an agreement that we need to change this. So at last year's Synod, we settled on a levy on property or non-offertory income. And in the end, we decided on a net, one based on net income that allows deductions for certain things for parishes, but where what any property income is effectively levied after deductions are taken off. So that's what we settled on last year. Now, in going to standing committee and in working on that, it was worked out that that might be a little bit complex and might have a limited benefit. And so the standing committee has come back and, not giving a view either way, has wanted to give the Synod two options. So the two options are basically the net option, which allows for deductions, or a gross option, which is less complex, but basically where any non-offertory income is levied by this small levy, but with a much higher tax-free threshold and reduced rates at each level. And so that's what we're basically deciding between at this year's Synod. Do we have the less complex gross system or the more complex net system? And so some people will argue for one and some for the other. I don't think it's a matter of great principle. We've just got to work out what's best for the diocese. I think it is important to note that we have agreed we need this. I think it'd be unfortunate if the Synod, in deciding between these two options, then threw out the whole idea. Each year at Synod, people argue for that, but what they don't realise is that just means we'll go back to what we had in the past, where that arbitrary distinction where people who have to bring ordinances to Synod might be caught under this, and those that don't won't be. Whatever we decide, whether it's net or gross, the Synod has already decided that this is the best way forward on this issue, that there be a general levy on property income.
Thanks, Phil, for nailing in on the heart of the issue there. So it seems that we need to move on from the current policy, which is not as effective as we would have hoped. We need to head to a new policy, and the question then becomes, which of those do we want? Do we want it based on gross or on net? One of the great things about having a number of people in the room is that we've all got areas that we're interested in. They can be different at times. And so it's worth a quick run around to see, are there particular things that are worth paying attention to? So, Claire, is there anything in particular that's grabbed your attention from the papers that we haven't discussed already?
Well, the three things in particular that I'd want to mention. One of the things that struck me this year is that there are some really good resources in the Synod papers and things that are coming to us. So in the first instance, there are two reports that we considered last year at Synod that were exposure drafts in a way that allowed for a period of interaction and feedback, and that are coming back to this Synod for adoption as policy. The first is the Domestic Abuse Policy and Good Practice Guidelines. So much work has gone into these, and they really are very helpful and biblically based and really a model of pastoral care. And that's due to come back to us. We'll be looking at that on the Wednesday evening in the first week. And well worth looking at. There's a flow chart and the guidelines for adoption in parishes that really will equip clergy and ministry staff in these situations. The other report is the Gender Identity Guidelines. We looked at the report and the policy last year and the initial principles. They've also had a time for feedback. There's been one minor change. And then what Synod will be asked this year to do is to adopt the initial principles as policy, and then a newly constituted committee will then work at producing guidelines to be brought back to Synod next year. The other issue, again on a matter of gender, is the gender representation on diocesan boards and committees. A report, well, this is in response to a resolution last year asking for a report on the participation of women and gender balance in boards and committees. So a report's been written with various recommendations, and that's coming back. And certainly one of the things that report notes is the increasing number of women on boards and committees. And a little note for the ACL at this point, which is this is one of the things that we've really been working hard at, to nominate more women, and we're really grateful and thankful that there are more women who are being elected to positions, and this report is looking at that and wanting to understand those things in a biblical framework, and also to advance the participation of women in the life of the diocese, because this is the way that God has made us to work together as men and women, but also to work and to bring their expertise to the work of boards and committees.
There's another policy that we'll look at this year. Last year there was a report on a review of ministry and licensing, and this report this year, called Voluntary Relinquishment of Licences. This report is a flow-on from the earlier wide review of licensing. To focus in, this particular policy provides a framework for parish clergy who wish to stop parish ministry. It provides some financial incentives or financial scaffolding, so that it may be for a whole variety of reasons a member of the clergy has come to the end of where they can effectively perform paid ministry, and they want to come to a good end. And so this is a policy which the Synod will be asked to put into place. There'll be some financial requirements that will come out of the PCR levy to provide these helps, but I think it's a useful thing to have in our diocese, where we have a lot of clergy and there's a variety of ministry, but there are just sometimes circumstances where you just come to the end, you'd like to finish well, there's no way out, and this provides a way, another possibility. So it's one that I commend to the whole Synod.
Thanks, Claire and Robert, for helping us on those items. And it's important to understand on the voluntary relinquishment that really it's a mechanism of pastorally supporting someone who needs to make a change. It's for someone who has no longer has capacity for ministry. It's not intended to be a means of discipline or anything like that. It's not saying anything about someone's character or their convictions, but it is helping people when they realise it's time to make a change. things that has kind of piqued my attention. It's been around a little bit, and it's an important topic to discuss. It's on the relationship that assistant ministers have in parish life, and also related to that, of course, lay ministry. There's some good work being done on that report that's helping us understand and set some levels of expectations of each other where there was really no clarity over that. It's helped to give us some framework and some clarity as how we relate to each other in parish life, what we should expect of each other, and hopefully to manage those relationships in a more positive way. The one thing to make sure we get this crystal clear is the distinction between ordained ministry and lay ministry, that they are distinct in terms of categories, in that one is assigned a role and another is employed for a particular job. And so therefore, we need to make sure we just keep those distinctions clear. If we start muddling the categories, it's really going to make it difficult for us to follow through on this consistently.
If I can just jump in there, Andrew. I mean, Andrew's talking about M13 on your current business paper, the appointment of assistant ministers and employment of stipendiary lay workers. But specific to that one, but more generally as well, it's just a really important point. We don't just think legally as a synod. It's really important that as we think about motions and ordinances, that we're thinking biblically and theologically about them. So as we think about the appointment of assistant ministers, we want to think about, what does ordination mean? What is the difference between an ordained worker and a stipendiary lay worker? And that's not just a legal difference. There's theology behind that. And I think that's what is so wonderful about the Synod of the Diocese of Sydney, is we're not just a legal body. We are driven by this overriding desire to see the gospel go out and to see God's word applied to our church life. And so I think it's a really helpful thing that Andrew has brought up there.
So, friends, we hope this has given you some insight into some of the more substantial issues for this year's Synod, and as well encourage you to make your voice heard this year and contribute to the quality of debate for the good of the Synod, but more importantly for the cause of the gospel through the work of the Diocese of Sydney. Friends, the Anglican Church League exists to help preserve and promote the evangelical character of the Diocese of Sydney. We do that fundamentally through seeking to place the right people in the right places, doing the right things. Integral to achieving this aim is the active support and work of our members, and this podcast is just one of the ways the Council of the League seeks to serve its membership and indeed the Synod of the Diocese of Sydney. A reminder, there are three things you can do from here. You can apply to join the ACL from our website at acl.asn.au. You can attend the Synod dinner, again, book and pay at our website. And you can sign up online to our daily reports from this year's Synod, either through Facebook or our website. My thanks today for our panel, and my thanks to you for taking the time to listen and prepare yourselves to serve this great diocese at this year's Synod. Goodbye, and we'll see you at Synod.